So today we will indeed talk about Tanzan aspect again, but this time on English. And we will be presenting the results of a study that we conducted with two postdocs on our team. The study is not yet accepted for publication. It's currently, we're about to submit the revised version, but we hope it will be accepted and it will be out soon. So, this last case study continues on the theme of time in language. And yesterday we talked about aspect in Slavonic languages, and we had a case study on Polish. And today it's going to be about tense and aspect in English. And as I said yesterday, there is a whole literature about aspect, but there's also a whole literature on time. And the question about what time is something that has kept researchers from many different disciplines busy for centuries. You have these discussions about time in philosophy, in physics, and also in linguistics. Linguists aren't necessarily interested in understanding the concept of time, but we are interested in understanding how time is expressed in language. And we rely on two concepts for this. One is aspect, which we saw yesterday, and the other one is tense. And what I've put here on the slide is the table of contents on a monograph of the topic of tense and aspect by one of the leading scholars in this field, Robert Binnick. He is now an emeritus professor. He used to be based in Canada. And as you can see from this table of contents, these concepts, tense and aspect, have a very long and very problematic history. Tense tends to be the easier concept of the two. It's said to locate, to capture different ways of locating events in time relative to time of speaking. And it has been debated since antiquity, though, as you see on the table of contents. We have ancient theories of tense, traditional theories of tense, modern theories of tense, and now we are clearly in section 4 going beyond theories of tense. Aspect is a different beast. As I said yesterday, the definition that's generally accepted goes back to Comrie, and it says that aspect refers to the different ways of viewing the internal temporal constituency of a situation. And generally, that means absolutely nothing to learners of a language that marks aspect. But I think it's also something that's very difficult for linguists to comprehend, because the first section in the part on aspect starts with the problem of aspect. And then you see the first subpart is Slavic aspect, which we talked about yesterday, which is a particularly challenging case. So although tense and aspect are concepts that are difficult to define, we linguists tend to be happy to acknowledge that these concepts are difficult to define and then just proceed using them for descriptive purposes. And generally for English, grammars assume that there are 12 different tense aspect combinations that arise from the combination of three tenses, present, past, and future, and four aspects, simple, perfect, progressive, and perfect progressive. And then, as I explained yesterday, there is something that's called the grammatical approach to aspect. On such a grammatical approach, you then define the abstract meaning of each tense or of each aspect separately. So tense is relatively easy. If I talk about something that happened yesterday, I will use a past tense. If I talk about something that will happen tomorrow, I use a future tense. And if I talk about something that's happening now, I use the present tense. And aspect, you know, we have tried to explain this in the same way. So simple aspect is used to express a fact. Perfect aspect is for actions which are completed but retain some relevance to the present situation. The progressive aspect describes an event or an action that takes place over a period of time. And then the perfect progressive is some kind of combination of the perfect and the progressive. And on such a grammatical approach, you have these abstract definitions of what each tense and what each aspect means or conveys. And then you can apply those concepts to unsuspecting verbs, to any verbs, really. So it's a really economical approach. And you won't even notice how terribly inadequate this solution is until you try to use it to teach the English tense aspect system to foreign learners of English. And I recall very, very little from my English lessons at school. And one thing that always struck me was that there was virtually no grammar to English. I was used to things like Latin and Greek, which are very similar to the Slavonic languages in all their morphological complexity. So then we had some English and there was virtually no grammar to English. And the only thing we ever talked about were these tenses or these tense aspect combinations. And what the teachers told me about those tense aspect combinations and what they meant might make, you know, really little sense to me. I still remember examples of, I've lost my keys. If you say that, then the keys are still gone and you can't get into your house. But if you say, I lost my keys, that means, that implies that you've got a new set already. I just thought this isn't grammar. This is, you know, hocus pocus. But that is what we do. So we explain what these aspects mean. We explain what these tenses mean. And then we assume that all of this can be applied to any verb that's part of the English lexicon. But so that's a typical grammatical approach. Of course, you all know that in recent decades, grammarians have moved to basing their descriptions on actual language as is contained in corpora. And then these corpus-based approaches have yielded somehow much more useful results. So the corpus linguists tend to still use the same aspect and tense categories, but they stay much closer to the relation between the verbs and the tense aspect markers. So you could kind of see this as a more lexical approach, like we had yesterday, the grammatical versus lexical approach in Slavic aspect. You have something similar in English grammar as well. So for example, Biber and his collaborators found that the verbs that are most attracted to the present denote mental and logical states. So that's, you know, I bet, you know, I mean. And verbs that occur most often in the past are verbs denoting, you know, speech acts such as say, reply. I see that my PowerPoint isn't exactly aligned. See, reply, ask, and announce. So I will go there. Yes, exactly. And then you see that, for example, when you're talking about the present but the perfect, you have another set of verbs that really aligns, I mean, that is preferentially used in that tense aspect combination. I have given, he has left, they have sold. When you look at the progressive, you find that in the present tense, again, specific verbs are used, like I'm starving, it is bleeding, things like that. And I think that it's much more easy to relate to this kind of explanation, and this kind of explanation is much more directly useful to learners, but because you give them examples of how they should be using these tense aspect combinations, and you give them like ready-made chunks, so to speak. But at the same time, it's a bit of a madness, because you will then end up memorizing specific verbs and specific tense aspect combinations. And as I said yesterday, this lexical approach has been used in the past in the literature, and people have always tried to limit or reduce the lexicon to a limited number of categories. I said Wendler had 4, the Russian Maslov had 20, but if we go the route that the corpus linguistic approach would indicate, we might have hundreds or thousands per cell. And then the question arises, if that's the case, then how do we actually learn these things? Do we simply memorize each individual item, or is there actually some system in this madness? Now, when you look at the British National Corpus and you look at how often each of the tense aspect combinations is used across the both the spoken and the written parts of the British National Corpus, you see immediately that there are two things that take up the vast majority of all the utterances. So the present and the past simple together make up more than 80% of all the examples in the British National Corpus. And that kind of reminds us of the Zipfian distribution, which is said to characterize language, that there are very few items that are used very frequently and very many items that are used not so frequently. We will take this as a starting point for discussion about the conceptual operations that might be, or the conceptual properties that might be supporting this kind of distribution. So you could say that those two most frequently used tense aspect combinations, the present and the past simple, they also express simple relations between event time, speech time, and reference time. So in the present simple, these three times coincide. So the time you refer to, the time the event took place at, and the time you're speaking are all coincide. And then in the past simple, you have event time and reference time that coincide, and they precede speech time. Other tense aspect combinations seem to be much more complex in the relationships they express between the speech time, event time, and reference time, and they provide less or fewer than 5% of all examples. And of course, this is maybe not surprising from a cognitive perspective, because the more complex things put a much larger burden on memory, and especially working memory, because what is important here, when to use these specific tense aspect combinations, you have to put all of your events, the parts that make up your speech event, in the correct order. So when you look at these two sentences that are both from the BNC and that express more or less the same thing, you see that in the first one, a simple past is used. So the officers tried to stem the flow of blood, the paramedics arrived and took over. The second one, the second example, says pretty much the same thing, but squeezes in a past perfect progressive. And that actually requires reversing the order in which the events took place. So you say paramedics were at the scene in 4 minutes of the emergency call and took over from officers who had been trying to stem the flow of blood. So the officers were already trying to stem the flow of blood before the paramedics arrived and took over. And in the first sentence, these events are put in the order in which they actually occurred. But in the second sentence, you turn things around. For that, you need, you know, there is some kind of backgrounding going on, some kind of foregrounding going on. You need a much more complex tense aspect combination, and that puts strains on working memory. We will get back to that towards the end of the talk. So basically, that is what we set out to investigate, as I said, with two postdocs, a current postdoc, Laurence Romain, and a former postdoc, Adnan Yazizi, on the team. And as I said, the paper is currently, we're ready to submit the revision, and fingers crossed it will get accepted. So what we want, the questions that we want to answer are whether all English tense aspect combinations are equally learnable from exposure to input, and which elements in the context, in the input, supports each of those tense aspect combinations. And also more cognitively, we want to know what the coordinates are of the English tense aspect system. If we do this large scale study of input, can we find out which dimensions of experience this tense aspect system seem to encode, or which dimensions of experience seem to be, you know, putting boundaries on the system? And before we start, I need to put in one disclaimer. So we will be talking about the present, the past, and the future. But there is we're kind of covering up a problem, and that's the problem with the future tense. And there has been lots of discussion as to whether there is a future tense in English. And the question has arisen because the future tense in English is not marked in the same way as the past and the present. So whereas the past, for example, has a morphological suffix ed, there is no such suffix for the future tense. And the future tense requires an auxiliary will or going to, which the past and the present don't do. And that this has given rise to a discussion in the literature as to whether the future is actually tense, as Michaelis wrote in her 2006 book. You know, you're using a periphrastic construction, so this tense is different from actual tenses. So some people consider that English only has a past and a present. Another group considers that English has past, present, and future. We decided to remain agnostic on this matter, so we will consider present, past, and future in our work. Now, another important thing that we need to bring to your attention, let's say, is that there are, as you know, in language, non-canonical viewing arrangements are possible. And this is illustrated by the following examples. So for example, when you say lunch starts at 12, or my mother is leaving tonight, you're using a present tense to refer to a future. And this is going to be, we know that this is going to be very difficult for our algorithm, because there is no indication. I mean, the algorithm doesn't know what time it is when you say lunch starts at 12. So if you are a human being and you hear someone say lunch starts at 12, you can look at your watch and kind of determine that maybe now it's only 10 o'clock. So this sentence must be referring to something in the future. That is something that our algorithm obviously cannot do. Or if you say my mother is leaving tonight, currently it's when you say that it's not yet tonight, but you know, this is also something that's difficult for the algorithm to sense, so to speak. And we think we will be able to only pick up on those instances where there is some kind of contextual elaboration, and the contextual elaboration needs to be available in text version, so to speak. So in the first sentence with lunch starts at 12, you can look at your watch, the algorithm cannot do that. In the second sentence with my mother is leaving tonight, the algorithm might be able to pick up on the fact that is leaving is actually not something that's currently happening, but that will be happening later on because there is this adverbial tonight. So again, this is, you know, construal in language, very easy for a human being, very difficult for a machine to pick up on. And it enables speakers to present situations in the way they conceptualize them, with, you know, with an algorithm will struggle with that. So that's something that you will need to bear in mind. Another of these weird situations is the example from Michaelis. It's one example, actually. I took a cab yesterday, the driver was Latvian. Now, when you see the past tense used in the second sentence, you know, because it's a past, it kind of seems to imply that the cab driver somehow stopped being Latvian. So he was Latvian when I was in the cab, he is no longer Latvian. That's clearly not what, that's not what's intended. Another option would be the driver was Latvian, so this is a past tense, meaning the cab driver actually died overnight. Also, that's not something that is that's intended in that way. So again, something that human beings find relatively easy, but that the machine finds hard. And our assumption is that actually, in most of these cases, especially in written text, there will be some contextual support that signals whether the tense aspect combination is used in a canonical way or a non-canonical way. And we assume that if it is used in a non-canonical way, there will be more contextual elaboration, especially in written texts where you have no, you know, immediate experience to rely on to make this explicit. So there are three important concepts that we will rely on in our study of the English tense aspect system, and that have also played a role in the literature, not necessarily in literature on tense aspect, but we think they would apply usefully to the literature of tense aspect. So one is the concept of complexity, which goes back to Rodenberg from a 1996 paper published in Cognitive Linguistics, where he writes, where he describes situation, the general situation in language that he's observed, that in the case of more or less explicit grammatical options, so if one option is more explicit and another option is less explicit, the more explicit grammatical option will tend to be favored, tend to be used in more cognitively complex environments. So in a more the more complex the sentence is formally or cognitively, the more explicit it will be. So the more syntactic elements will be present to guide the interpretation. And we expect that this will hold true for tense aspect combinations as well. So the different tense aspect combinations embody differences in conceptual complexity, as I illustrated with the two examples from the BNC. And we think that simpler forms will be reserved for describing simpler situations. But, and we expect that more complex forms will be reserved for describing complex situations, but we expect that the differences in formal complexity will extend beyond the verb into the context and will affect the amount of contextual support that the writer or speaker provides and that he feels or they feel is adequate, that they need to achieve an accurate representation of the intended conceptualization of the event. Now, a second important concept is distance, and in cognitive linguistics, it's known as epistemic distance, which is or captures the location of an event relative to a speaker's sphere of knowledge. So Chilton, in his 2013 work on tense and aspect, argues that things or situations that are spatially close are also epistemically close, and we extend this idea to temporal distance, and we use it to explain how epistemic distance increases cognitive complexity and therefore the need for context. A third important concept is the concept of uncertainty. Only that which you have experienced is certain, and only that which is occurring at the time of speech is close. So if you apply the concept of uncertainty to tense and aspect, then you can say the past is, you know, you have experienced what's happened in the past, so it's distant, but it is certain. What is happening at present is close, and you cannot really say whether it is certain or uncertain. In certain circumstances, you will, you know what's going to happen. In others, you may need to wait for a while. And then the future is distant and uncertain. And as for aspect, we can say that the progressive is close because it is developing as we speak, whereas the perfect with completion is more distant. And when we put these things together, we come to the following summary, so to speak, which also is kind of the guiding hypothesis for our work. So if we look at tense aspect combinations and we look at the contextual support that we expect them to require, we can see on the left-hand side here that there is going to be little contextual support required for a present simple, and most contextual support would be required for a future or a perfect progressive. So there is a bit of a climb from present over past to future and from simple to perfect progressive. And that has to do with those three concepts that I just talked about. Okay, Peter, over to you.
Thank you. So now we are back again to learning and our kind of generic or general approach of modeling as much as possible. So just to corroborate different sources of data that we can generate. So yesterday, there were also some questions asking about the order of analyzing data. Should we start with corpus? Should we do when to do computational simulations before or after experiment? And then we also, a few days ago, we also discussed that there are two possibilities where you use simulation before your experiment to actually generate very strict, very precise hypotheses, or after the experiment that typically follows corpus work, which then this computational simulation serves to confirms externally almost experimental results. So generally speaking, the question is again and again about learnability and then from this cognitive plausibility. Breskolo-Wagner rule, as we said, and I will just repeat briefly, it basically builds and runs an estimate change in strength of association or weight between a cue that can be, in our case, word or a phrase, but we also discuss very kind of historically important case of dog in Pavlov's lab, that for the animal cue was either a bell or light or something like that. And then an outcome, which can be, in our case, again, word, linguistic abstraction, experiential notion, and so on and so forth. Again, in the lab, in animal type of learning, that would be food, some kind of important important notion or concept. As I said, in our case, we care about language, so cues could be words or phrases, and outcomes can be, they could be words again, also, or some abstractions and higher order notions. The change in association can be driven by positive evidence, and I will go into that again, just to remind you. When both cue and outcome are present, we said when cue is not present, then the logic of this is that there is no learning because there is nothing, there is no new information, essentially. And then when cue is present, but the outcome is not present, then we need to change the weights or decrease the strength of association. This is how we learn. We always correct our current predictions. This strengthening and weakening of cue and outcome association does not happen in isolation. What is very, very important is this competition between cues. They always compete to run the show, to take the primacy and to be the most important cue for an outcome. We can think in that in those kind of terms. Interestingly enough, if number of cues increases, that then in a sense overall competition increases as well. So positive evidence will become less important with many, many cues, but negative evidence will become more and more important. So somehow with the increased complexity of learning situation in terms of number of cues, when you have a positive evidence, then that with increased number of cues becomes less important situation. And then at the same time, negative evidence becomes more and more important. Next slide, please. Sorry.
I think you've covered that.
Yeah, mainly I did. Maybe it's interesting just to remind. Well, yeah, maybe it's just interesting to remind people about a couple of references if they're really interested in that. There is an original paper from 2011, Vine, Millen, Djurdjevic, and et al. And then two more recent ones, or even three, I would like to suggest. So one is in 2017 in PLOS, where the focus was also to explore what information can be extracted from learning network, not just association strength or activation, which was typically used from beginning of connectionism, let's say, so where you have certain cues and then you just sum up their weights to see which outcome is predicted. But in some of my, let's say, analysis of those, of properties of those learning networks, I realized that there is much more to that. And then the interesting parts are also those negative weights, the strongest negative weights, and many others. So this is discussed in 2017, more in greater details. And then I think it's important to check Dagmar's paper from 2015 with Sizemore and Socha Mikalik, if I'm pronounced well, and then two of our papers in 2016 and 2017, where we also discuss some implications of this kind of, let's call it, learning approach. Next slide. So again, questions that we were asking were, how well can the model predict expected outcome? And what kind of cues are actually helpful in these predictions? So we wanted to go very in greatest possible details to understand the growth of those relationships and which cues are particularly informative, let's call them like that, for a particular relevant outcome. Next. So we used naive discrimination learning. This is again based on Ryskolo-Wagner rule, where, as I said, strength of association between cue and outcome is modified by experience. That's another way to look at the same positive evidence, strengthening, negative evidence, weakening, and so on and so forth. Importantly, NDL is conceived to mimic human learning, also to account for restrictions on memory, for example. Now, this is what you already saw in some of previous talk. This is just a reminder for you. How does it work? As I said, if you have a positive evidence in the first row, so QA is present, outcome X is present, then you strengthen this association. In the second event, you have Q, but different outcome. And then you strengthen that association. At the same time, you weaken the first established association. So between A and X, things get things need to be weakened because prediction was wrong. If you predicted X, that was actually incorrect, but A and Y needs then to be strengthened. And this is again just a summary of the critical bits of actual formal model, because Ryskolo-Wagner can be considered to be a formal model. Again and again, it is identical, or even Ryskola phrased carefully, in principle or in generally speaking, it's identical model to Widerøe-Hof. So that's important to know. Critical bit is this delta W, which marks the change in association strength. Update basically is defined as a previous state, previous association strength plus that change plus this delta W. So you have WT plus delta WT, and that gets you new association. And then again and again, we have positive evidence when outcome is Q needs to be present. But when outcome is present, then we have positive evidence. Otherwise, we need to account for erroneous prediction. Now, we did something new just for fun, and not just for fun, because there were principal reason to think about that.
Linguists in the room.
Yes, exactly. You
and we never want happy,
never satisfied. You need more. Anyways, so the point is that thus far, what we did initially in early years at 2011 and those five first years, and even later, we were mainly concerned with either those letter pairs or letter triplets to words, or how words are predicting other words in context. But since Dagmar and I started working on this, building this methodological approach, we also, I would dare to say, we kind of diversified types of learning situation. In 2017, we also used behavioral profiles as cues for word forms. And here in particular, we went even step further and we said, okay, we cannot just rely on isolated words. We need to look into larger units, and then we introduce chunks. Still, we kept things naive in the sense that we used very simple raw input text sentences, and then on top of that, n-graphs. And on the next slide, I will explain exactly what those chunks were in particular. So this the point is that queues were n-grams. So we identified chunks from 1 to 4 words. We took 10,000 most frequent ones of each length, and they were retained as our learning input queues. So example of chunks would be n-gram would be isolated words like definite article, past, few, years, days, and so on, so on. Bigrams would be the past, few years, few days, and so on and so forth. Trigrams would be consisted of 3 words, and finally quadrigrams would consist of 4 words. So we went pretty pretty far, and there is also, just by the way, there is an evidence of effect of 4 grams or quadrigrams in some of psycholinguistic studies that are, I don't know exact year, but I can check because I still remember authors. So that was also not based on just like out of the blue, but we kind of founded this build of chunks to some previous empirical work. Next slide. So this is just to give you an example. If we start from this sentence, and we have a sentence that has critically has managed as our focus, as our relevant outcome, and then we need to build relevant association weight between cues and outcomes. So in the first instance, the question is, what are our cues? So as you see, we have some isolated words like since then, but then we also have a bigram since then, and he too, both single unigrams, but also word bigrams, and so on and so forth. Here we just presented bigrams, but you can have the set, you can get the picture that we could build up to quadrigrams. So it would be a short phrase. Importantly, again, we retained frequent chunks. So if you think about possibility to combine, to go up to 4 words, to have a combination of 4 words, then you are in trouble because you can have many, many combinations of 4 words, much more than you have words. So it's just like a combinatorial explosion in principle. But to kind of sidestep that issue, we just kept those that are actually frequent that could make the difference, so to say. And then in next step, what we did is that we tried to predict relevant outcomes. And in this particular case, we are presenting 4 relevant possible outcomes. And importantly, as you can see, for example, for present perfect, we have certain red connections between some cues and outcomes. Those would represent positive weights or positive connections, positive associations. Those that are blue, those are cold or negative. That means that since then would be negatively associated to present simple. And as same, but bit weaker with past simple, and so on and so forth. Again, what is just Dagmar, if you can go back just for a tiny brief, but we will re-summarize once again. Manage is also present as Q, and it's marked in different color also because it's infinitive. So we didn't actually use the form, and we used infinitive form to help building the prediction. So we know the notion, we know the action that verb needs to express, but not exact tense and aspect. Okay. So what are the cues? Just the summary. First of all, we have row inputs. It's just a normal sentence. Then you have this has managed as a critical outcome. Context then would be all other words in this situation. So since then, he, then we skip, has managed to remain the spiritual leader of his people. And then finally, cues are all those isolated words and combinations, including infinitive, which in this on this slide is capitalized. Next. So what we used as a data set is British National Corpus, roughly about 100 million words. About 7 million learning events were extracted. Each included engrams plus infinitive, and all sentences that contain a verb tag, all sentences containing a modal auxiliary were discarded except will. So this was just a light a selection of data. You can check, first of all, you can check our Python package on our GitHub page if you want to see how it was, how the pre-processing of the material was done. How did we do tense aspect annotation? So we actually applied certain, let's say, informed heuristics, in the sense that our linguist expert added more and more. She was checking what was tagged incorrectly, and then she would suggest a correction, a new heuristic to fix an error. And that happened in iteration. So that was back and forth work between a computer scientist and linguist, where linguist added more and more specific information to correct for errors in previous iteration of annotations. So we checked manually sample of 1,000 sentences, and when we achieved the accuracy between 95%, then we basically said this is good enough. Anyway, even if you have human annotators, you would expect that they disagree, and some error margin would be even in that case present. Okay, learning from co-occurrence and data. We had more than 6 million training events, which consisted, which was like 90% of the total data. And then we used 350,000 testing events or learning events that were used for testing, 5% for validation and 5% for actual final test. As I said, cues were, we had 44, almost 45,000 cues, engrams and infinitives, up to 4 grams, as I said. And outcomes, we use 11 possible combinations of tense and aspect, but we excluded future perfect progressive because it was super rare. So you just don't have enough data to actually model that tense aspect combination. What did we achieve? Overall, 68% of accuracy on 11-way choice. Keep in mind that actually if we would run a system that is based on pure guessing what tense and aspect combination is in a given sentence, in a given example, then it is expected to achieve 9% of correct guessing, but we achieved so much more. So we were reasonably happy, and there is more to that. So we will, I think, continue going into details after the break.
Excuse me?
We may start now.
Yeah, it's okay now?
Yes. Okay.
Yes. Okay. So as Petr said, we got a 68% correct prediction for an 11-way choice, which is, you know, way above chance level, which would have been 9%. But there were interesting things to notice about our success, so to speak. So as I showed you at the beginning of this talk, there is this Zipf-ian distribution in the data where the present symbol and the past symbol together make up more than 80% of the all of the instances of tense aspect use in the corpus, so to speak. And as you can see here, where we plotted the prediction accuracy per tense aspect combination, you see that the same thing happens again. So present simple and past simple are the two tense aspect combinations that are most often predicted correctly. So the present simple was correctly predicted in 86% of all cases and the past simple in 73% of all cases. The other tense aspect combinations remain very low and together kind of amount to something like 3 to 5%. So there are a few tense aspect combinations that the model predicts really well. And then the majority of the tense aspect combinations, which are also the tense aspect combinations that aren't used frequently, are rather poorly predicted. Now, when we check whether the model has predicted the correct tense aspect combination, what we do is we take the first or the preferred choice for the model. So the model can actually only present us with one option. But that's not really accurate or fair on the model, so to speak, because in many sentences, more than one tense aspect combination is possible. And as we saw when we looked at examples of the articles in English, not all speakers necessarily agree on which option to choose. So, what would happen if we take not only the first choice of the model into account, but also the second and the third option that it suggested as possible given the context? And that kind of mimics what human beings would do. They wouldn't all necessarily make the exact same choices as the authors made of the texts that are included in the British National Corpus. So when you look at this example, recently more and more of us have become concerned about environmental issues. The model's first choice was a past simple. The second choice was a present perfect. And in fact, the second choice is the tense aspect combination that was actually used in the sentence. So I'm gonna let you do a little exercise. If you see the sentence, "Pleased to meet you, he," and then you have to come up with a form of reply, what would you choose? Had replied, has replied, replies, will reply, or replied. And in the next sentence, if you plan on staying, what tense aspect combination would you use for plan? Would you choose, which of these five would you choose? I see that my slide isn't actually showing you the examples, but what is going on here is that generally we see the more the native speakers diverge in their choices, the more uncertain the model also is. So if there was only one option possible according to the native speakers, the NDL was much more likely to also suggest that model than in cases where native speakers were, you know, differed in opinion. And when native speakers differed in opinion, we also saw that the model differed more in opinion. And we will get back to that in a few slides. But for now, I just want to show you what happens when we take into account cases where the model second guess retrieved the tense aspect combination that was actually used in the original BNC text. And we see that things look a lot better, and not just two tense aspect, as, combinations are learned to a reasonable standard. In fact, 7 here are learned better than they would have been retrieved if we would just have, you know, let chance play a role. And we see that the present perfect is the tense here that benefits most from this, from taking the second best prediction into account. Now we can also go down to and take into account the top 3 predictions for each tense aspect combination. So if we count all of the 3 preferred predictions of the model and take those together, then our model reaches a prediction accuracy of 93%. And which is again significantly or substantially higher than this threshold of 27%, which would have been reached if the 3 predictions had been made randomly. And it's also higher than the threshold of 88%, which would be reached by always predicting the 3 most frequent tense aspect combinations, so present simple, present past, and present perfect. Here again, the accuracy increased to well above chance level, even for many complex tense aspect combinations, especially past perfect, present perfect, and future simple. Now, because we saw this phenomenon or this tendency appear that the model doesn't always have the correct answer as its top choice, but very often the model has the correct answer among its top 3 choices. And on the other hand, we see that native speakers don't necessarily agree. So some contexts allow the use of multiple tense aspect combinations. We decided to look into this in a bit more detail, and we conducted an online survey with 65 participants. They were all native speakers of English. They were given 25 sentences from our corpus, and they were asked to fill in the blank by choosing 1 out of 5 tense aspect options, and those options were chosen based on NDL's predictions. So we always gave the top 3 predictions and 2 fillers in case the NDL prediction actually contained the correct prediction, but we also gave it the top 3 predictions supplemented with the expected outcome and only 1 filler when NDL actually hadn't made the correct prediction. And we see that this table summarizes the agreement between the model's predictions in the rows and the native speaker's preferences in the columns for the use of a specific tense aspect combination given a context. So as you can see in the top left, most participants, so 81%, succeeded in retrieving the actual tense aspect combination that had been used in the original text as included in the British National Corpus when NDL did this too. And participants were more likely to miss selecting the actual tense aspect combination when NDL missed it too. So in row 2, you see that 35% of participants chose the tense aspect combination that our model chose, but that was not the actual tense aspect combination used in the original BNC sentence. And then we also found that participants' responses were more varied when NDL placed other tense aspect labels than the actual one in its top predictions. And for example, in row 1, the first cell gets the bulk of the data, 81% of the data, whereas in row 2, it's spread between the first 2 cells. And then in rows 3 and 4, the responses are even more spread out, indicating even higher disagreement. So then to go back to what we saw in our initial model. So the model that only takes into account this first choice made by the NDL algorithm. And when you compare that to the distribution of tense aspect combinations in the British National Corpus, you could say that what's going on here is that learning follows, by and large, the natural frequency distribution that you can see in the text that it has been trained on. So present and past simple make up the bulk of the usage. And you could simply explain that by saying, well, we know that most things in language have a Zipf-ian distribution, which means that a very few things occur very often and most things occur relatively rarely. And then the conclusion would be that, well, things that occur more frequently are also learned better. But when we looked in more detail, we saw that it's actually not what is going on here, but because we found no correlation whatsoever between the frequencies of the Q outcome co-occurrence and the association strength that the model had calculated between the Qs and the outcomes. So the conclusion must be that it's not because things occur frequently together that they become strongly associated with each other. Frequency of occurrence does something else. And we found some really interesting things when we went digging into that. This, for example, is what happens when we use a balanced data set. So when we select equally many examples for all of the tense aspect combinations in our sample, we did that here, and we could only include 7 tense aspect combinations because the others were too rare to give us a large enough sample to train on. And then if you do that, so if you remove the frequency advantage, you see that completely different tense aspect combinations are learned well. In fact, the present simple and the past simple are among those that are learned worst. So we were really curious to see what's going on there. And kind of find out why this simple present and past are seem to be especially hard to learn without their frequency advantage. And for this, we took a look under the hood, and we went into the cues that drive our findings. So this is the measure that we used here was so-called activation support. That's the minimum difference between the activation of the outcome that's of interest and all of the other outcomes. So the higher this value is, the stronger the activation of the outcome of interest relative to other outcomes. And that means that they're stronger, the support provided by the set of cues that is present in the context provides stronger support for the outcome of interest. And these things are, I've just given you a few here. Here's the present simple and the past simple. And on the next slide, you will see the future simple and the present perfect. And I've color coded the strength, so to speak, of the activation support. And we see that for the present simple and the past simple, everything's green, meaning that the activation support is really high. But when you look, for example, at the present perfect or the future simple, you see that the color is yellow, which means that the activation support is actually weaker. And this interesting split emerged in the data when we compared the cues that strongly support, or the strength of the support that you get for present simple and past simple, and that you get for present perfect and future simple. And what you see is that the present simple and the past simple are strongly supported by the lexical items themselves. So all of the cues that are, you know, among the top 20 cues for on the left-hand side of the table are lexical items themselves. And these are verbs that are strongly associated with the present simple, such as I thank you, I suppose, I hope, I remember, I hate. And for the past simple, you have lexical items that are very strongly associated with the past simple, such as I replied, he whispered, he murmured, he nodded, he smiled, etc. Other tense aspect combinations, such as those on the right-hand side of this table, the present perfect and the future simple, they are strongly driven by our engrams, our chunks, such as we already, since then, or for example, it is hoped, hopefully, will or will not, etc. So this will remind you of what the corpus linguists found, who have long argued that, you know, linguists should stay much closer to the data than we are doing. So there is some similarity in the cues or the contextual elements that our model flagged up and what had been suggested in the corpus literature as being relevant contexts for the use of the different tense aspect combinations. And we did this because we're working computationally. We can actually do this on a much larger scale than the corpus linguists could who work manually. And that means we can gain deeper insights about language, but also about learning. And this chart here contains the distribution of each cue type, either contextual engrams, as you can see, 1 gram, 2 gram, 3 grams, and 4 grams, versus lexical elements. And lexical elements are in pink. And this is the distribution of these queue types in the top 100 queues for each tense aspect combination. And you can see that, relatively speaking, the present simple and the past simple rely on lexical queues in bright pink, while the other tenses are supported by n-grams in any of the other colors, and of course 1 grams, 2 grams, 3 grams, and 4 grams in different proportions for the different tenses. So it seems to be that frequency plays some kind of an indirect role. It's not the more frequent combinations are learned better, it's the frequency with which the tense aspect forms occur decides what type of cue can come out tops. So for example, when we compare the present progressive and the present perfect on our conceptual, cognitive conceptual interpretation of these tense aspect combinations, we would say that present progressive is more immediately experienced. It's also more lexically supported. And the n-grams that we see are kind of situational things, such as we are about, understand what, know what you. Whereas on the other hand, when you look at the present perfect, which would be a more distant tense aspect combination that needs more contextually support, the n-grams very often include a temporal adverbial, such as since then, or so far, recently, or already. And just to show you that frequency does, you know, plays this really weird role here, we calculated the exact same thing for our balanced sample. So for the sample in which we had removed frequency and only let, I mean, and considered as many examples for each of the tense aspect combinations. And what we see here is that this proportion of lexical, strong lexical cues is significantly less than in the natural frequency distribution. And we see that it doesn't differ all that much for the different tense aspect combinations. So we see that, you know, all tense aspect combinations in this balanced sample had some lexical support and some n-gram support, but overall mostly n-gram support. So this shows that the frequency with which this tense aspect combinations occur decides which type of cues can come out strong. And we think that this is the case because the lexical inventory of a language is finite. So verbs will have to be repeated once the tense aspect combination becomes very frequent. So if you see here at the top, present simple and past simple, if you calculate the type and the token frequencies, you see that there are like over 3,000 types and, you know, roughly 150,000 tokens. So, you know, the verbs that occur in these tenses need to be repeated. But when you go down the list, you see that this type frequency reduces significantly. You have like this middle layer of present perfect and future simple where we have roughly, you know, 1,000 to 1,500 types. And then we have a bottom layer of the most complex tense aspect combinations where you go, you know, be from 200 types down to 85. So tense aspect combinations that occur less often than there are verbs in the input, they are cued by n-grams. And tense aspect combinations that occur overwhelmingly more often than there are verbs in the input are cued by their own lexemes. We can also cut things up by tense or by aspect to see which combinations get most support. And for all three tenses, the simple aspect is more strongly supported than the perfect, and the perfect is more strongly supported than the progressive, except for the future. So we could say that the strength of Q diminishes also with the complexity of the form. And we can cut it up by aspect as well. So for all three aspects, we see that the present is more strongly supported than the past, and the past is more strongly supported than the future. So we could say that there's a correlation between the strength of the cues and the proximity of the conceptualizer to the event, or the certainty that the conceptualizer has about the event. This is just to give you the numeric values that underlie the table I showed on the preceding page. So tense aspect combinations which describe situations or events that are known or certain, such as the past or the present, or that express a simple temporal relation, such as the simple aspect, seem to be more strongly supported. And this kind of brings us back to, or brings us to, Laniker's elaborated epistemic model, which may be a strange thing to see after a computational modeling study. So you see that the present simple and the past simple would be at the core of this graph. They refer to immediate or known reality, and that's conceptually simple. It comes as no surprise then that they are also very frequent. These temporal arrangements are easier to conceptualize and talk about. And because of the frequency, so they're easy, so they're used more frequently. And because of the frequency with which they are used, lexical cues can come out strong. So the number of times we use these tense aspect combinations exceeds the number of lexical items we have at our disposal, and verbs start to be repeated. So in a sense, everything conspires for us to learn these tense aspect combinations easily. They are conceptually simple, which means that they're used frequently, which means that things need to be repeated, and all of that makes it easy for us to learn them. Other tense aspect combinations either refer to some kind of an unknown reality, which is the case of the future, or they refer to conceptually very complex temporal arrangements, such as we saw in the example with the paramedic stemming the flow of the blood, events ending in the past before another past event commences, etc. And these are cognitively very demanding situations to conceptualize and express. This, you know, it, as I explained, this narrative sequencing, you need to sequence events in a way that doesn't mirror the sequence they occurred in your experience. And this requires quite a bit of working memory capacity. And it's also something that only develops later on in life and very often is dependent on reading. So narrative sequencing is an advanced writing skill, and it's typically explicitly taught in schools, and it is also supported by reading the right kinds of texts. And that kind of creates a bit of a vicious learning circle. So these complex tense aspect combinations are used less frequently because they're cognitively very demanding, but because they are rare, they're also harder to learn. It takes much longer to build up evidence of things that are rare, that don't occur very frequently. And this may be another reason why the cues that we see are contextual. So there are plenty of verbs to go around. Construction isn't used very frequently. So n-grams are actually the more stable element. So yeah, this is just to go back to this, to the example I showed earlier. In the first sentence, the sequence is straightforward and depicts the events chronologically and simply. And the second sequence organizes the events as they are construed by the speaker. So there is a focus on the paramedics and the officers are backgrounded, and that requires the use of this less immediate tense aspect combination, the past perfect progressive. But in your mind, you need to turn around the events and change the event order or the event sequence from how it happened in reality to how you need it to be presented in your narrative. What is really important is like the type and the strength of the cue. So if in case you have simple tense aspect combinations, then the cues are equivocal and frequent. And when you have complex tense aspect combinations, you need to rely on contextual cues, and these are fuzzy and the occurrences are rare. And we think that, you know, this is what creates this kind of a learning or a learnability conspiracy. Some tense aspect combinations, conceptually easy, used more frequently, need to be repeated, which means that the verbs they are applied to are repeated. And these single cues are easy to spot. Whereas on the other hand, you have the complex tense aspect combinations, which are conceptually complex, which means they are used less frequently, which means that the verbs don't repeat, but the context becomes the stable element, but that's much harder to spot. So there is kind of a split in the tense aspect system, but we wouldn't say that it is a split according to tense and aspect. We think that what the data shows us is that there are two systems, a simple lexical one and a complex contextual one. And they are shaped by cognition and by usage in such a way that one is eminently learnable and the other one is much less learnable. So going back to the question I asked at the beginning, if we go on what we see in the data, if we follow this, you know, inspired by this corpus linguistic approach that keeps a close relationship between the tense aspect marker and the lexical item, I asked the question, do we then really need to resort to item by item memorization? Do we memorize for each of these individual verbs which tense aspect combinations they preferably occur in? And what we found here is that there does seem to be a system in the madness, so to speak. It has to do with simplicity and complexity of conceptual situation and associated form, which then influences frequency of use and then gets the learning machinery spinning in different ways. So I've already said all of that. So it's not about tense. It's not a distinction between or a contrast between tense and aspect, but it has more to do with simplicity versus complexity of initially the cognitive situation, which then is mirrored in the formal expression in language. So we hope that this last case study is kind of, you know, again, an illustration of what we want to achieve with our research team. So we want to take a holistic approach. We want to study usage in context. We also want to take a cognitively realistic approach and limit or shape our cognitive or our linguistic theory in a way that chimes with the way in which human beings learn from input. As Petter has mentioned many times over the past 10 days, our learning algorithm is really very simple. It's not a cutting edge engineering solution that can perform better than humans can. And we do that on purpose. We want our machinery or our computations to be transparent and to be tractable. We do that specifically because we want to understand the mechanics, because we think that the mechanics can teach us something about how human beings learn and what that means for language and cognition. And the nice thing for linguists is that the output of our learning algorithm is actually suitable or available for post hoc semantic analysis. We can pinpoint exactly which cues were important for exactly which outcomes. And then it's up to the linguist to dig deeper and, for example, notice that, oh, but this is interesting. These tense aspect combinations are all cued by lexical items. Those tense aspect combinations are all cued by contextual items. What might that mean? And before we wrap up this very last lecture, I wanted to share with you the link to our webpage, where you can read more about what we do, where we also post recent or accepted publications that have come from our project. We also have a very active Twitter account where you can follow us and either find out what we're doing that very day or that very week, and where we also recruit participants for studies that we are conducting. Given the pandemic, we have largely moved to conducting studies online, so it's much easier for people who don't live in Birmingham to participate in our study. So we would be very happy if there would be anything you would like to join to have you as participant on our study. And last but not least, if you would like to come to Birmingham and work with our team for a while, send us an email on our team email address, which is given on the slides here. We do need to say, please write to us well ahead of time. There is a lot of paperwork involved in getting the university to accept someone as visiting scholar or visiting PhD student. If you write to us a week or 2 weeks before you need the paperwork, that's unfortunately entirely impossible. And not because of us, but because of all of the procedures we need to follow to be able to get you the paperwork we need. So ideally, write to us, say, 3 months before you would like to come, if not 6 months before you would like to come. And that would leave us enough time to get everything sorted. So thank you very much.